Accession number 10165, reel number 13.
Martin McLean, reel 13. You were telling me about the naffy chit system.
You could maybe get 2 and 6 months worth of naffy chits in one current week off the company clerk, and these were debited against you. Now, these naffy chits were just a simple thing that you took over at the naffy, which is the Navy, Army, Air Force Institute, where they supplied the eats, the food, the tea, as it is today, for the troops, and the beer, if you so wanted it. And it, with these tickets, you could purchase whatever it is you wanted. And so these things were debited against you. And it was the CQMS's job. We used to call them colour sergeants. Now some people call them staff sergeants today. But his job was to balance your accounts each week and produce a balance of payments required for the payout of the men for the end of the week. And he'd deduct from you the company stoppages, the sports fund, the naffy fund, which I'd already mentioned, the naffy tickets, and he'd take them off you. And every now and again, these accounts were scrutinized by the senior officers. The company commander would keep a tight grip on it, so there was no fiddling. Obviously, there had been fiddling occasions, but the CQMSs were supposed to be trustworthy men, but they kept an eye on them. There was a fiddle later on in life, which the CQMSs got involved with in a big way. And I'm only seeing one or two who get the lads a very bad name. We started a regimental association.
When was that?
1933. We started a regimental association run by a brevet Lieutenant Colonel Sherry, who was a quartermaster at the regimental depot. He thought it was a good idea to have an association of ex-servicemen, Durham Light Infantrymen, so that when they finished the army, they could come for help or advice and be given it, which is the start of the big extension you see now at Durham. Well, the CQMSs, Lieutenant Colonel Sherry came down to the battalion one day and put the whole story of the thing to each company in turn. And as you went out of the dining room where they held the lecture, you had to nod if you wanted to join the association, and they'd take your name. Well, I didn't want to join because I had something against Colonel Sherry. Don't ask me why. He maybe had crossed me, but I didn't like the man. I says he's not getting my money off him for a spend on beer or things like that. But it was a wrong attitude. I just got me craw. I didn't want to join until I was ready. I didn't want to be forced into anything. So it was then the CQMS's job to take off a guinea subscription, which made you a life member. Now, a guinea was a lot of money to us them days. At the rate of 2 bob a day, then if you got your efficiency pay, plus included in that was your marksman badges, plus all your stoppages, at the end of the week you didn't have much money for yourself. And then as you made allowance, like I did to my father, which reduced me to about 7 bob a week, and then my stoppages off that, I could draw about 5 shillings a week. Well, any more inroads on that, well, you couldn't afford your cups of tea, and more so your mepo and your shoe polish, which you use a lot of, and things like that. So I couldn't see my way clear for the pay. Of course, I'm now in with a lot of old soldiers who are higher rates of pay than me. The CQMS has then had to take this a guinea a week off the men, a guinea for life membership, at so much a week, or so much a month, in accordance with what the company commander agreed upon. Maybe 6 months of each man who agreed to join per month. Well, sad to say is it now relates, a lot of this money didn't arrive at HQ. A lot of people who thought were members of the association are not even on the books. Now, this is a small racket, not done by the officers that were running it, as it turns out, a big one. It's a bit of a slur on the battalion, but you asked me a question and I must answer it truthfully. Yes, they kept the money for themselves in some instances. Not all of it, but some of it. And in consequence, some men who thought were life members of the Durham Light Infantry Association were not members at all.
And that was in 1933?
1933 onwards.
When was this fraud discovered amongst the colour sergeants?
It was discovered many, many years after the events, after the war, because certain people used to go along and write in for their DLI Association badge to find that they didn't have a one. And when they made investigations about why, they found that payments hadn't been made. And the only possible way that payments couldn't have been made was through the CQMS, who had the responsibility of forwarding this money onto headquarters, whether he passed on to any senior officer or anyone apart from that. But an awful lot of the men were not now life members of the DLI Association. If you ask Dick Thornton at Durham, he'll vouch for that.
What about any other sorts of financial irregularities, selling of leave passes or overnight of night passes, selling of stores? Was there any of that going on, do you think?
Well, not that I'm aware of, and I was deeply involved with the troops. As far as passes, for men going out, once a man became an old soldier, he could stop out at 12 o'clock at night. If he wanted to stop out later, he just put an ordinary pass in, which was never refused. But I've never known of anyone having to bribe or fiddle, because it's more than the WO or NCO's life is worth, because a man is denied this privilege of staying out or going out is wrong. He's been up to some trouble. I've had one little incident of a fraud, which is the only one I can recall in my mind. That was after the Arakan.
Oh, we'll come to that then. I'll make a note. Now, I think the next thing that happened to you is you were sent to the Army Small Arms School.
Yes.
Which one were you sent to?
Well, it came to notice of the battalion that the battalion had been selected as an experimental machine gun battalion. Now, during the First War, there was machine gun battalions, but they had been made defunct. And each battalion, infantry battalion, had a company of machine gunners. But the powers that be thought they'd try out the scheme of machine gun battalions specialists. And so we had been nominated as an experimental battalion to go down to a place in Blackdown in Surrey, there to become Vickers 303 machine gun battalion. Now, to prepare for this, I was sent for by the company commander and wondering what had gone wrong. I was up for an interview, and he told me that I was Lance Corporal, but I was going to have the privilege of being sent on a senior ranks small arms course on the Vickers 303 machine gun, which was really a boost up for me, and that I'd be given the acting rank of corporal for the period of the course, and that I'd go down there with two sergeants, some other corporals, and some other Lance Corporals similar to me, who would be required for training the battalion in the Vickers 303 machine gun once we received the weapons. So there was a spate of sending NCOs off on this course to the small arms school at Netherhaven down Salisbury. That's Swindon, isn't that Swindon? What's Salisbury anyway? I forget the name of the county. I went down there. And
this was in 34 still?
In 1934. This would be about October that I went on this thing. And I went down there and I went with my eyes wide open because, you know, I'd been in the army a couple of years now and I'd seen other people on train and I've seen them. But this was a huge congregation of troops, Scotchmen, Irishmen, Welshmen, people from all of the armed forces throughout the whole of the British Empire. They were coming from India and from Palestine and from different places for this course. And it was a huge number of people taking the course. And we were split up into different with different instructors. And I had a man from Scotland, I forget his name for the time being, Cameron, I think it was. He was in charge of Crawford. His name was in charge. He was in charge of my section. They'd put about 10 or 12 men, 10 men, I think, in a class. And then when we assembled for our first morning parade, it was then that I realised how outstandingly smart the Durham Light Infantry was in their own little prideful way. You see the men with their shrevens up and their khaki, just ordinary khaki shrevens, khaki skillet arm badges. And that was the Durham sergeants on parade. It was a bit of a ceremonial, this coming in, with the sash on, the red sash, as all the infantry sergeants had. The corps then did not wear sash, nor did officers. I see they wear them now. And they wore the incoming whistle and chain, which was a battle honour given to the Durhams, which only WOs and sergeants could wear. It's a brass chain with a lion's head, which had a fine double chain, which used to loop down in front of the body, and used to tuck the belt, the whistle in front of your belt. It was a battle honour given to them through the Battle of Inkerman, where there were the men, the WOs and sergeants, roused the men by blowing whistles when the Russians were coming at the attack on a. In short, the regiment won the day, and for that they were entitled to wear this medal. Well, seeing the sergeants with their sash on, the Inkerman whistle and chain, and the special chevrons with their green backings and the skillet arm badges made them stick out like a mile, and also had these smart, superfine caps, whereas everyone else was wearing these teddy bear caps, which was a rough-haired type of cap, which was the army issue. I thought what a proud little crowd the Durhams were, and it's from then on I became very impressed with the regiment. We then split up into different classes, and I went off with an instructor called Crawford, who, to be an instructor at the small arms school, a man had to achieve 2 distinguished passes in some sort of weaponry course, the rifle course at Hythe, and maybe the weapon training at Netherhaven. They were excellent instructors. This particular one was Crawford, and he assembled us round, and they take us right through the elementary stages of the Vickers 303 machine gun. And from there on, after teaching us, well, we knew very little of the machine gun, so we were learning all the time, but this is where my territorial training came in good stead. I knew the machine gun. I knew it, all the stoppages. I knew the drill of it. So what I was getting fed by this instructor was a refresher to me, whereas to the other lads, sad to say, who didn't do so well in the course, some of them, including the sergeants, it was new to them. And then it built up from there to the firing of the gun, and then the scheming and practice of the tactical side of it, which was taken by officers, the movement of guns, the overhead shoots, and all this technical thing of the Vickers 303 machine gun, which I absorbed. I loved the whole course. Now, it was at this course that I realised how much a Geordie I was. Instructor Sergeant Crawford was taking us one day, and it was our time for individual instruction. They give you a little set piece for the practice on the class. My particular job was stoppages of the Vickers machine gun, and it had many stoppages. But once you learnt the drill of knowing what the stoppage was, you could remedy them very quickly, like cross-feeding the belt, or the poles not getting over the round, or the ammunition being too tight in the belts, or a split round in the barrel. All these things you are taught, or the spring not being too tight to allow the gun to come back. You used to do them in a scheme like what they call in the army immediate action. In other words, as soon as you saw the stoppage, you could do immediate action to repair it without having to go to workshops or anything. You could remedy the damage or the stoppage. My turn to give this, it was my turn to give a lesson, and this is what I had to speak on. So we're all full of trepidation, you know, a bit trembling in front of strangers, hussars, Scotchmen and all this, that even our class was a mixed class. And I get down behind the gun, and afterwards I thought I'd done a good effort. It's great, you know. Great, I've done that all right. I felt it in my bones. But the instructor says, I want to see you when a class dismisses. Well, that was a sad note, because when the instructor said that to you, your chances of being sent home is not likely to be make an official instructor were tremendous. And that was the death knell for an instructor. So that was my day finished. Until the end of the lessons, I went over to him. He says, right now, he says, I'm a Scotchman. He says, I was the only one that understood what you were talking about. Your Geordie is appalling. He says, but you speak that way. But when you're talking to a class of other men from the other parts of the army, you go and ask them. They had not one word, one clue on what you were talking about. you're going to have the crank handle, you put it right back in the roll and do this, do that, do that. In broad Geordie. I mean, it was the language of its own them days. We are more civilised with the television and wirelesses. We pronounce and speak 100% much better than what we did them days. And it was then I realised how true he was, and then I started having to learn to speak properly, much to my disgust, having to speak a foreign language to me. And then, anyway, at the end of the course, after a very hard 7 weeks, they announced our gradings for instructors. And all part of this was, you go the whole school and a whole host of officers from other units onto a huge exercise in Salisbury Plains. And you do a sort of shoot, or do a sort of scheme. They used to shoot all over with the Vickers machine guns on Salisbury Plains, because the whole area was vast and they had red flags all around the boundary, something like Otterburn. It was about the only open range there was. And you'd have spectators come from foreign armies and everything to watch you in this little sort of scheme, even the German army, Austrian army. And our particular scheme on this day was withdrawal, whilst defending a fighting withdrawal. And in this, the selector spokesman. Well, in our class, we had a man who already had one distinguished mark from the small arms school, which means he was an excellent instructor, from the rifle and small arms school, as they called it, the tithe. And he was our spokesman because he was a machine gunner and he knew what it was, but he couldn't do all the speaking. He had to delegate the speaking to someone else, and it was my turn to speak in front of all these people of things. But this man had me so much impressed in his ability and his knowledge of the gun that I somehow absorbed what he was saying about how to withdraw, what to do, and this and the other. And I was asked to give my explanation of the withdrawal to the whole of the people there, which I must say a lot of the instructors had to, in their little schemes, somebody had to do the spokesman. And apparently I'd done it well. The outcome of the course was, sadly, one, the sergeant's got a fail, which is understandable if you didn't know the machine gun. I mentioned I knew the machine gun through the value of being with the TA. And I was glowing with pride when I was announced I was a Q1. Well, Q1 means a first-class instructor. And so I was well applauded, the battalion, for it. The command officer thought it was great. One of our other lads, who was another private soldier with me at the depot, were joined together, were in the same squad together, great friends. He was a machine gunner at the battalion. He was in our support company. And he's a lad who had joined the army, given the wrong age. He was much older than what he was. He was good at sport. He's a good rugby player. That's how we teamed up together, him and I. Well, he got distinguished. And we came back from there and returned to the battalion. And there was two failures. And I think there was one distinguished, two Q1s, and then Q2s and 3s down below. And I enjoyed that course. But the thing that stuck out in my mind was the standard dress of the outstanding dress of the Durhams, which made me more proud of being the Durhams than ever.
What happened about this conversion to a machine gun battalion then? How did that go about?
When we came back from the course, the battalion in the meantime had moved down to a place called Blackdown in Surrey, Deepcut Barracks.
They'd moved there in November?
They'd moved, yes. And we went down, and it was a cold, miserable night when we landed down this strange camp. And the battalion was in a throes of drills, carders, and double sentries, guards and sentries drilling and everything. And because they hadn't the machine guns, they were filling in the time by serious hard drill, company drill, formation drill, and this double guards and sentries in case they went to the palace. Settled down with the battalion, I was still in the same company, and then we got our machine guns. And then became a full-out exercise to teach the men the Vickers 303 machine guns and all this sort of thing. And it went on for some time, this. And apparently the battalion made a good success of this because they became experts in the field of shooting, because they went down to Netherhaven on the army shoots, and S Company, which is our support company, won the shoots, And our two companies, C Company and B Company, were close runners-up. And that's in the whole of the Army. And it's a laborious, hard, long shoot, overhead shoot. Overhead shoot means you're firing an enemy that you can't see firing overhead, using instruments to give you the elevation and range. And then a short while after this, we had three machine gun companies, and we had, I might as well tell you on this before I change, we had one anti-tank company. Now, this one anti-tank company was selected as A Company, and they equipped them with Carden Lloyd tanks. Now, the Carden Lloyd tanks were those small whippet tanks, as so termed, that were used in the First World War, that were always giving trouble on the road, they were always breaking down, and these ones that we got in particular seemed to be well worn. And their job was to wander around with a gun, a token gun on the back. They didn't have a gun. It was just a thing on wheels, a mock-up, just indicate it was an anti-tank gun. As I say, it was experimental. Everybody's now getting involved with trying to get better and more efficient weapons for the Army. We received in our mechanization in the company, we were well equipped. We received American tractors with bins on the side that could pull all of our machine gun kit, no bother at all, across country. It was driven by tractors, by trucks, and a trailer on the back. And we also had trucks for to carry our other stuff. So really speaking, we were a mechanized battalion in every sense of the word.
How many machine guns would you have to your company then?
Well, there was two to my section, and there was three platoons. Now there's four guns in each platoon. So that meant you had 16 guns to a platoon, to a company. And when they'd done a shoot together, it was marvellous to see it. You know, rattle through the ammunition, but you had to be careful on them. Use too much ammunition. At 200-odd rounds a minute, you could rattle them up with the guns, you know, firing belt after belt in the war. They used to have a bottle of water around the barrel. And when the gun got too hot, it used to blow off steam. Which went through a condenser tube into a condenser can of cold water, which condensed the steam back to water, so it wouldn't give you a position away. Anyway, a short while after we had the machine guns, we made a great success of it the first year. One day I was taking the men on machine gun instruction when a runner came in, he says, "Pack up, no more machine gun instruction." The machine guns had got to be handed over. We couldn't understand this. The lad had been sent out from company office to stop all training. The machine guns were eventually handed over at the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. It was decided that we were no longer a fit unit to run the machine guns, although we had made an outstanding success of it for a machine gun battalion, which machine gun battalions followed the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, the DLI, the Middlesex Regiment. They took up the role of machine gun battalions. Well, we had to hand them over because they didn't think the higher authorities at War Office didn't think that the machine gun battalion was the right role for the light infantry battalion, which is fair enough, but why didn't they think of it sooner? So they changed our whole role again. We remained an experimental battalion, so they made us into a scout reconnaissance unit.
November 34 when you started being issued with machine guns, all the process started. Yes. When was it stopped?
Well, now you ask me a question, it's my memory's getting old. I couldn't exactly say, but it was, I'd say, about a year and a half. I could be wrong on that score, but
so into 36.
1934 we went, 1937 we moved off, so it must have been a year and a half, because then we changed to a scout company.
Now, in that time, hadn't you been sent to regimental depot?
Yes, that's right.
That was before...
When I was a machine gunner.
That it was stopped. Mm. Well, let's look at that now. Could you tell me how you came to be sent to the regimental depot and what your reaction was?
Well, it quite unannounced to me, I was sent for an interview by the company commander. And he said, "I'm sending you to the regimental depot as a third instructor." And I was crestfallen at that. I didn't want to go, although it was my hometown. My whole life was the Army. I make no exaggeration about that. I loved the Army. With all its hardships and roughness and the outdoor life, I loved it. And the depot meant a more close, confined job. But I had no option because the instructors that went to the depot were specially selected. And so it was really a privilege to be sent there. I went off the depot on my own and arrived there, and I landed up in with a squad just forming called the Salamanca squad.
The same name as what I had. Now, when roughly would this have been? This would be sometime in 35, would it?
It was 1935, about that time, yes.
Do you know which season?
It would be later on in 1935. We'd completed our shoots and everything at the Vickers machine gun, and I never give it much thought, but you know, you just accept this in passing. So it would be about the end of 1935 when I got the depot. Yes, 35. If I look these things up and make it a thing with dates and everything from the book, it wouldn't sound the same. So I'd got the depot somewhere in 1935 and I landed up with Salamanca squad. Now this was the same sort of thing that I was involved with as a recruit, but more an advanced stage. Now I was responsible for the 40 lads who were forming the squad, 42 as a matter of fact, and it was our job to make them into soldiers. And the Lance Corporal's job in our particular case was interior economy. Interior economy entailed the housing of the lads in the barrack, ensure they knew how to make up the beds, how to make up their kits, how to clean themselves, how to wash themselves, how to keep the barrack room clean, how to lay it out for inspections, how to lay kit inspections, how to dress themselves, and multiple other jobs. Whereas the sergeant and the corporal, they assisted, but they didn't live in the barrack room like I had to live, so we were solely responsible, more or less, for these two barrack rooms of men. Matter of fact, we had an overflow. There's so many men, some men were in another barrack room.
Were you using the same methods as had been used on you three or four years before?
Very much the same.
So you had shiner parades and all?
It was, well, they laid down a syllabus of training through the company commander's office, and then they'd have a shiner parade on. But in addition to that, every night was shiner night. Every night you'd tell the men, right, shoe night the night. Polish the studs of your inspection shoe. If an inspection was coming up, what the blokes used to do is put their boots on and go and slide outside, so they got them glossy. And the heel plates and toe plates, full of steel, the sole of your boots, them days. And then they'd have to work on the tops to get the tops shining. We used to insist that the toe and the back part, the heel, the back leather forming the heel strap, was polished, and the rest not so hot. But we insisted on them being a high state of polish, because we realised the young recruits couldn't get this new leather up to the standard of efficiency that the wood is trained soldiers. Once it wore the boots and had been used and worn and spit and polished, then they'd get them up to the standard expected in a battalion. So we used to get them on, polishing shoes or mess tins or other shiny objects, show them how to make up their kit, fixing up their shirts, their spare shirt, into boards, and their socks into boards, so that they... We used to put cardboard in so that they'd all be square, nice and neat, and a towel, so that when they laid them on the bed for inspection, they'd all be nice and neat. A shirt with the towels in line with them, two pairs of socks, and a towel in the middle, and a hold all in front. We had a regiment way of putting them down, so that the men could lay a kit a little bit each night, so as to build them up for the eventual day they had to do it. About 8:30, 9 o'clock, they say, right, well, lads, the canteen's open. And you'd let them free, but they went off the canteen and had a cup of tea or a pint of beer, whatever it is they could. But then you were back, when they were back, you were in charge of seeing them into beds, seeing them by the beds, see them into bed by lights out, see that nobody absent. Orderly sergeant used to come around, you used to report everybody present or somebody missing. You used to take over the painting of the barrack rooms. You name it, we done it. The tables of the barrack room, we struck on a new idea. It actually started by a fellow called Pat Brennan. He was there as an instructor. He'd been there before me, a great man. He took commission during the war, and he wanted me to take one with him, and I wouldn't. He was the last man in the 2nd Battalion killed. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. He struck upon the idea of these tables that we had. They always had to be polished and scrubbed, not polished, scrubbed. And in consequence of this, you are getting splinters on the top of the table where, when you're writing letters home, you're in place, you could write. Or the naffy, if you had the time and the quietness, you'd write letters there, or do a little bit, whatever you had to do in reading papers or books. You used to get splinters in your hands. So Pat thought the idea, he says, I'll deal with these two as well. If you can imagine a 6 foot, about four or five planks nailed together, with a steel edging round the corners, and a bolt run through each, from one side of the table to the other, holding these pieces of steel together. Well, Pat decided to dismantle it. He took the steels off, took the tables outside, and got some caustic soda and scrubbed the tables so that they were white, absolutely white. And then he had the table ends burnished. Now, they were burnished in the first instance, but we used to scrub them. And he had them burnished with this bolt straight through them. And then he reassembled the thing so they had a white table with these silver, beautiful steels, silvered, with burnishing. Now, a burnisher was a chainmail thing that we used to buy, like the brevet. You see them wearing by the lancers now on the shoulders, little bits of chainmail. That's what we used to burnish the table ends with. So, and our bayonets, by the way. And